Welcome to The Hammer, where we hit the nail on the head with insights from the world of Canadian renovation and custom home contracting. Now here's your host, the editor of Canadian Contractor Magazine, Patrick Flannery.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to The Hammer. It's Pat Flannery coming back at you again. And today I have Lior Margulies with us. He is a real estate lawyer for Robbins Appleby. And one of his people sent me a note a little while ago saying he had some things to say about mortgage defaults and sort of the present environment with your contracts, with your projects, and with the increased risk that's out there now. There's been some big things in the news lately about developers having to sue people over canceling their projects because of mortgage defaults. And Lior has been looking at a lot of this and knows a lot about it. I believe 40 years in the business or something is the number that was in the material that I got. So but with that, I'm going to welcome Lior and get you to introduce yourself and I guess talk a little bit about what you're doing for Robbins Appleby, Lior.
Thanks, Patrick. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you and your listeners. 40 years in the business. Yeah, I started when I was a child prodigy, so we won't talk about age. I'm Robbins Appleby. I co-head up the real estate group, and I lead their development group, which we do a lot of high rise and low rise work for quite a few years. And you know, we're involved now with project closings that both low rise and high rise, both small and large, that are all challenged depending on the timing of when the sales were done and the location of the property. So it's a very topical issue that we've raised, and the newspapers are full. The Toronto Star loves to it has its daily bad news real estate story. It's very rare that there's a good real estate story. I've actually spoken to them and been interviewed on a number of the project problems with the State View and Merriman Homes, and whatever comes up, they seem to like to reach out to me because I have a familiarity both with the receivership side and also the Tarion side. I've been working with them for also 30 years very closely, and the issues it percolates everywhere, purchaser defaults or more often the builder defaults,
We could probably do a whole other podcast on Terry, and that's absolutely. Would be like, after 30 years of exposure, I bet you've got some stories. That's good stuff. And Lior, I'm grateful for your bringing the perspective both from the large side and the small side. Of course, our listeners here tend to be the smaller contractors, but you know what, there's lessons and information that flow back and forth across the divide. So I think it'll be really, really neat to have your perspective here. First of all, let's set the stage a little bit. I think when we look at the present environment, I think for the last couple of years on the business generally, the interest rates, I think, are the thing that spring to mind that's really impacted everything that's been going on. You know, the COVID era was roaring. Everybody was super busy. Couldn't get supplies, of course, by the end of it. Then the rates went up to counter inflation, and things have gone into a bit of a doldrums. We may be coming out of it now. Tell me from your perspective, what has the effect been, and what is it doing in terms of the amount of risk to their contracts that project owners, developers, and then by extension, the contractors take on?
Well, I mean, it's not only the interest rate issue that has made people or hurt their ability to finance, whether it's a purchase of a new home, a custom home, or a renovation. That's for sure is a huge issue. The other huge issue is values. Depending on, again, you know, we're talking about purchase of, let's say, a new home. The values that people bought at during COVID in particular, where prices escalated dramatically for low rise more so than high rise. The high rise prices did not escalate in any huge fashion. They already had their escalation before, but for low rise, come late 20, early 21, as you said, there was a huge boom in housing, and those prices have escalated and no longer can sustain those values. So when people are going for their mortgages and looking for financing, they are facing now a double whammy. It's like a perfect storm. They can no longer qualify for mortgages because based on the stress test, which is a 5-year rate plus 2%, they're out of the ballpark because of their earnings have not gone up that dramatically. And number two, if they're financing a new home that they purchased for, let's say, $1 million, or a custom home for $1 million, and then they go to the bank, leaving aside their ability to cover the cost, the bank will say, well, you may have paid or thought it was worth $1 million. In this current 2024 market, it's worth 800,000, and they will only lend against the 800,000, which means if they're lending, let's say, 80%, they only lend, you know, 80 times whatever, 640. And you were expecting to get 800,000. So now you have not only a potential inability to finance any number, but the number that you're getting is lower. So suddenly you have to come up with more cash. So those are the big problems that are facing individuals right now. And consequently, they're facing, you know, builders who are selling either at prices that were higher or building at a higher price. And it's impacting on the purchaser's ability, purchaser or homeowner's ability to finance that purchase, no question. And the later in the market that you bought or you valued your property, the bigger the issue is on the drop in values. And as I said, for low rise, that's the biggest problem. If you bought before 20 or your value or your custom home was valued before 20, then you're probably less exposed to the drop in value. You still have the issue on affordability, on the your financeability, but at least you're not facing suddenly you need to put in another 100 grand because the bank won't lend it to you.
Mm.
So that's sort of the double whammy that everyone's facing now.
What's your sense of that of the magnitude of the problem, sort of area to area? Do you think this is an issue really everywhere in the country? Is it a big urban center issue or is it kind of going on everywhere to your mind?
Well, the interest rate issue is an issue everywhere. Everybody's facing the same issue. But the values is really a question of where you bought, in what marketplace. Some, you know, 905 and 705 marketplaces, went up dramatically between 20 and 22. They went up 30, 40%. It's staggering. And those properties, if they're now trying to find financing, those are the properties that will face the biggest problem because you won't be able to get the amount, leaving aside your ability to finance it. You won't be able to get the amount. So it's those areas that have seen the biggest run up, probably areas in Vancouver, maybe in the East Coast, you know, even in Montreal has had, you know, big run up. So, I mean, I don't have a litmus test across the country, but we know that certainly in the greater GTA, it was a frenzy between late 20 and until they started ratcheting up the rates. So it was like a year and a half frenzy of price increases.
So let's say you're a custom home builder and you're taking on projects. People are obviously financing these projects through various means, but it, you know, normally it's going to be some sort of a mortgage situation. Perhaps you've even taken on the project or even a major renovation, and these things are subject to financing or the person, you know, is going to have to go and get it leveraged somehow. And in this environment, we have the increased risk that something is going to go wrong with that process. They're not going to be able to afford it. They're going to get declined. They're not going to pass the stress test, et cetera, et cetera. I guess describe for me what are the measures our listeners should be taking to guard against getting into that kind of a situation? How do you protect yourself?
Well, if you're talking about a custom or a major renovation, it's really a question of managing your credit risk, right? Mm-hmm. So first of all, and we're talking major. So I'm not in that business, but if I was, these would be the things that I would be looking at. Mm-hmm. Where's the guy getting his money? It's fine to sign a contract and says you're going to build a house for, $3 million on his land, or we're going to do a gut job and it's going to be $400,000. It's not enough to just sign and hope he's going to find the money. I would be asking, where are you getting the money? Well, I put on a HELOC on my property. Well, let me see the terms so that I know you have it. Or I've got, I'm independently wealthy, or I won the lottery. It's the type of thing I'm extrapolating from what my builders do on the project side of things. Mm-hmm. And when a purchaser's buying a home, we want to know that he's got the ability to close. And the issue should be no different from a custom builder or a renovator. Does mm-hmm. he have the ability to finance it? So when we sign a contract, they have to provide us with evidence that they've got a mortgage takeout that will cover them. It may have to get reviewed and renewed because there's a time, it's 3 years hence, or they provide us with evidence from their accountant, whatever, they got money in the bank there, they got the $900,000 to cover us, something to give you some comfort that they have the ability to finance. When we do major, contracts for contractors, they quite often in the standard CCDC contract, it says you got to provide evidence of financing. It's not just a clause in the agreement. It's like, I don't want to get in bed with somebody and then I find out they can't pay. That's the worst thing. So maybe you'll lose some people. But if you're making a big investment, you're hiring people, you're buying supplies, you're committing, I don't want to end up in a lien situation. That's not my source of payment. Yes, that's my protection, but that's not my source of payment. You do some due diligence up at the front end, and now you do even more. So that's what I'd be doing with my homeowners. Yeah,
exactly. You mentioned liens. And again, I deal in the commercial side of things in other with other hats on for other magazines that I produce. And I know that there's major complaints over there about the construction lien process, and that it isn't that effective as far as safeguarding your receivables. On the other side of it, what's your sense there, Lior? How easy or difficult is it to get a lien against a project that you're working on, and how effective is it to try to enforce that, I guess, in the event that something goes south?
I mean, they tightened up things for contractors with the Construction Act a few years ago with the early payment and dispute resolution and so on. It is what it is. It gives the contractor a right to tie up the property if he's not getting paid, and a process to get paid. Now, if there's mortgages on there, they are behind those mortgages, so that's always an issue. Other than the 10% holdback, so that's the protection. It's a last resort, because once you have to go to lien, you're done working with this guy. And on a big project, you lien the project. You're done there too, and you stop the project because there's no more mortgage advances. So it's a pretty serious step. On the other hand, if you're not getting paid and you've hit the wall, it is effective. It stops the person from selling or refinancing, and it forces people to the table to sit down and work something out. And now with the mediation and dispute resolution mechanisms that have been inputted in the new Construction Act, it's helpful. Look, it's still a last resort. And as I said before, you're much better off taking the protections that you can to assure yourself as best you can that these people have jobs, have an income, have a financing if it's a HELOC, or they're taking out a mortgage, or they got money in the bank because they won the lottery. That's where it's important. The liens are there. But then it gets ugly, it gets expensive, and you're going to end up after you pay your lawyers and you're going to end up getting 70 cents on the dollar if you're lucky after you pay all your costs and you're successful. It's something that it's there. It's better than just having a contractual dispute and suing and not having any security.
Yeah, it's always a last resort for sure.
Right.
Let's say to a younger contractor, somebody just getting into the business. What do you recommend they collect as far as when you're trying to assess the value, assess that ability to pay? What kind of documentation can you ask for? I mean, I guess what's going to end up offending people and bothering the kind of like how far do you think that should go?
Well, I mean, it's there's no right or wrong. It depends on the size of the contract and who you're dealing with. But I mean, if we're talking a significant contract for the young contractor, they should be asking for. They can do a search of title, and if they see there's 12 mortgages on there, you got a problem. Mm-hmm. They just got one conventional mortgage, and you can get a sort of evaluation of that. You go to your real estate agent, get about, so you know how much equity they have there. That will give you some comfort. But you still should find out how they're proposing to pay for this $400,000 contract. Do they have money in the bank? Are they taking out another mortgage? Is there a line of credit or a HELOC that's going to pay for it? I should be able to tell you that. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. You should find out, who they are. It's a business. You do a credit analysis of who you're dealing with. It's no different that it's an individual or a consumer versus a business. You can do an Equifax search and see, where do they work? Do they have judgments against them? Are they suing a million people? Like, to be honest, and it sounds like, oh, Lear, that's a lot of work and time. And well, you know what? Hiring a lawyer and going through a lien action, it's going to look like child's play. So really, I know I'm sort of beating the same drum. I try and keep my clients out of litigation because once they get in there, no one's happy. So do your due diligence up front. And if you lose a couple of clients, they were probably clients that you shouldn't have taken on. Oh, I don't want to tell you this. Oh, well, that judgment, that was this and that. So you spend a little money, but if it's a material project that you're going to make some money, so you invest a little bit of time, with Equifax and, a writ search and, get your, do a quick title search. So it costs you a few bucks, but I would do that because people are going by a hope and a prayer and they're going to sign a contract. Oh, they got a nice house and they look like nice people. That's good luck. I'll be seeing you in court, be with your liens,
A title search is definitely a good idea. What's involved with doing that? I personally thought that was something a lawyer had to do.
Yeah, a lawyer or a clerk who has access. Yeah. So, to get a copy of the PIN and a copy of the deed and see what they paid for it and what mortgage is on there. It's not going to cost you a fortune. And then you can evaluate, then you might be able to say, I know this area, they paid $1.5 million for it and they've got 700 on it. Market hasn't changed that much. At least I know they've got equity. I don't think that's enough. Like I said, I want to know that they can pay for it. So they have equity. Great. So I have a lien and eventually I get paid. That's part of it. The other part is how are they going to pay for it? They have a job, they have an income stream. They got money in the bank. Again, it's a twofold. What's their asset? How are they going to pay for it? And I think they should be making those inquiries and also, a little background check on them. Like I said, the Equifax doesn't cost, you should be a member of it anyways, or whichever credit agency you want to use. And you do some things, what's their thing? Do they pay their bills on time? It's a very good litmus test. And you may find out, these people, they don't pass what my, late partner who ran our group, Jerry Tobe, said it's got to pass the smell. They have to pass the smell test.
Right.
If they don't, give it a pass. I know it's a tougher market. Years ago, you could be more tougher, and now there's less business. But you know what? One bad file takes up all your profit. So I encourage the vigilance.
Yeah, I think what happens, what tends to happen with a lot of people is they're relying entirely on the smell test, Lior, and it's like, yeah, they walked in and they had a nice conversation with the person, and they looked around their house and at their car, and they said, oh, they seem to be all right, and they're going forward on that basis. But I like what you're recommending, that maybe you have a checklist, a procedure, you have a set of documents, questions you want to ask, just some evidence you want to collect before you go out there and buy those materials and commit the time and turn away other jobs, all of this stuff. It's just that sort of, like you say, upfront due diligence. That's, if you think doing that stuff is expensive, well, try not doing it and finding out what you get into, like you say, trying to enforce liens and the rest of it. Right.
Right. Right. Exactly.
So when things is the lien process, I guess that's really your only recourse. If you've committed to a project and the people attempt to back out, for whatever reason, their mortgage is defaulted or there's a cancellation, there's a failure to pay, talk a little bit about this new, and it's newish, mediation process that is out there. Now, is that something that can exist between a contractor and his final client? I thought that was something for sub trades with the general contractors. Can a contractor go through that with the project owner?
Yeah, it's the payor and the payee, I think. I don't think there's a distinction. It could be between whether you're the owner and the contractor or the contractor and a sub, they're there again. It also depends on the type of contract that you sign with your purchaser. That's a whole other story in terms of having, a proper custom home or renovation contract. But the mediation clauses are, that come out of the act are helpful. They help bring them together, but at the end of the day, they only work to the extent that people, want to talk to each other. And usually the problems are sometimes financial, but quite often they're quality issues. Mm-hmm. All the ones that I've seen are 9 times out of 10, the purchaser or the homeowner is taking issue with the contractor in terms of the timeliness or the quality or the deficiencies, and he starts holding money back, and that's where most of them come. In this market, you may now have suddenly the guy loses his job, or because he's had to renew his mortgage, he has less money to pay. There may be issues in terms of the actual financeability, and then they start looking for reasons why they want to cut down the payments. So that will just exacerbate the situation. And so that's, again, I go back to doing as much due diligence as you can and keeping an open communication. Going into the hint, going into hiding when there's problems. And I say this for every aspect of my business, whether you're dealing with your bank, whether you're dealing with your purchaser, keeping the lines of communication open with them. It may not solve the problem, but not answering them or just sending emails. Emails is a terrible way of communication. Emails are good for passing information. You want to know the status. This is coming tomorrow. We're doing this. The cost is this. Where it's clinical and informational. Where it's a discussion or a negotiation, or there's a problem, don't yell or criticize it in an email. You can set out the problem and they say, we have to have a call. You can yell on the call. That's okay. But yelling on an email, it's wrong, and it doesn't get you to the end. People don't like adversity. That's what I've learned, whether it's in an organization or between customers and their builders or trades. And at a certain point, you have to talk to each other. And if you do, it's amazing people will not say what they put into writing, because writing is, it's, you're behind a shield. You send all this stuff, you send it off and goodbye. Well, when it gets on the other side, it's like throwing, it's great. You throw a Molotov cocktail out there and you go home and it's great. But the Molotov cocktail is going to explode somewhere else. And better you get on the phone if it's really blowing up and raise it there. Yeah, you know, even if you have to get a little excited, better on the phone than on an email. So I go back to the communication. You do have to communicate with your purchasers. And if there's problems, you've got to reach out to them. And if you're hitting a roadblock, then you set up a meeting and maybe you can't overcome it. But generally you can, you know, if you're dealing, you know, I can't guarantee it, but talking to people a lot better than emails.
Yeah, I you know, I think that was, and it, to your point, I think that was kind of the intent of the mediation process that they set up with the prompt payment thing, was that, you know, instead of it being a court proceeding and you're in front of it, well, you are.
Right.
Well, it's not a judge, but it's a master.
A
mediator.
Yeah, it's a master.
Yeah, they've got some kind of, I think they use, it's often retired judges and stuff, isn't it?
For the mediation, yes. Yeah, that have mediation practices, yes, that's true.
Yeah.
And they have some idea of construction.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. They get people with construction backgrounds, and they get people that are out of law backgrounds. And then, yeah, the idea is that, you know, let's come to an agreement and get the, and then the mediator can make a decision and get money flowing without, necessarily a court case, because that can take months and years, you know,
The mediator doesn't have an ability to make a decision.
No,
he's,
they can
just try and bring the parties closer together and go back and forth and try and get them to agree. He tries to bang heads on both sides to get one to come up, one to come down, one to, you know, show the weaknesses of their cases. And, you know, it sometimes it works, you know, quite often it doesn't, but it might at least narrow the issues, perhaps, you know, it's certainly a useful mechanism.
Yeah, that's basically the concept there. But as you say, it's a last resort. That's what's happening when things have gotten seriously sideways. And as you say, the relationship with the customer is over at that point. I mean, you know, you're now in a situation where people are just trying to extract what they feel they're owed from it. And you mentioned a figure, I sort of off the top of your head, of, you know, if you do end up in legal proceedings over defaults on projects, you know, you're probably, your best case scenario, I would think, is that 70 cents on a dollar you mentioned. I mean, the fees are going to eat up most of what you're ever able to recover. Right.
Oh yeah, no, for sure. And that's why, you know, small litigation is brutal, because the cost is the cost, whether we're suing for $100,000 or we're suing for $1 million. You know, you're going to go through the pleadings, the mediations, the motions, and the productions, and experts. So, you know what, I've told clients, both on the contractor side and on the owner side, you know, a bad settlement is better than, you know, going all the way or and putting your life in the hands of a judge, because for two reasons. Number one, you never know where it's going to go. Number two, there's a huge cost. Number three, the cost is not just paying Robbins, Appleby, and the experts. It's the cost to your business, because the time that you're spending on this case to collect that 50 cents on the dollar, you could be going out and doing other business. So what is it, both actual time and also mental time? And you have to put a value on that. And people don't, until they've been in it for 3-4 years. Then they understand. You try and tell them that and say, no, he owes me the money, or he's a terrible builder, I'm not paying him. But then you spend all this time. So that has a huge value, and people should really appreciate that. So at the end of the day, 70 cents is really not, you'd be lucky. And like I said, the smaller the amount, the more it cries out to settle, because you're just going to waste time and effort. You know, if it's really huge, you know, then you have to look at the cost benefit and the total cost, the indirect and the direct. That's what I try and tell people.
So, Leo, we've offered some good advice to our listeners on the smaller side of thing, but let's step into your world a little bit. What's going on with the big track developers these days? The note came through obviously about the stories about, you know, big problems with big developments, multiple people defaulting and not going in. Is that something that's, you know, there's more and more of that going on, and how are the big developers reacting?
Well, I mean, you know, having that one case that was in the paper about the 2060 falls, I don't know that project. I find it a bit it's unusual. On the low rise side, you're going to see more of the defaults on the low rise side because of the huge run up in prices.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're facing the interest rate cost and the value issue. I think, you know, we're seeing a lot more requests for extensions and assignments where purchasers are, you know, can't afford it or need more time to get their financing. So far, you know, we have a lot of low rise projects. We've had that have closed over the last year. A number of mid-rise or high-rise projects, and the number of actual ultimate defaults where purchasers were not able to close has been relatively low.
Okay.
But the getting people to close has been a lot more challenging and time-consuming. But most people have been able to do it. Now, part of the reason is most of those people were in the money. So we're talking about low-rise purchasers who bought, you know, before, let's say, 19 or early 20. Mm-hmm. And so if they can't close because of their financing ability, there's still value there, and they are, you know, they've been able to find others that have been able to close. And same on the high rise side, you know, high rise takes a much, much longer. So I'm looking at high rise launches that are predate COVID. So mainly some in Toronto, but mainly in southwestern Ontario is just the ones that I've closed the last year. And again, more challenges on assignments and extensions, but very few because, again, they're in the money as well, too. I think the big test will be the next 12 months because you're going to see more low-rise units that were sold in late 2021, and those are not necessarily in the money. And so I'm expecting more difficulty. And high-rise, investors have, you know, the problem with the high-rise is you got investors who have 3-4 units. And they just can't, you know, even if they're in the money, they can't afford to pick up these units because they were banking on a 2.5% 5-year mortgage, and now it's 5% or 4.5%. So will we see more of those? Yeah. Again, they're leaving big deposits behind, right? 20-25% is a big number. And, most most builders, that's enough to cover even the drop in the price. And it's also an encouragement for purchasers not to walk away from the deposit and try and find somebody, but we'll probably see more. How much more? I'm hoping it won't be as bad as the papers. Papers like to take one or two situations and make it seem like it's a whole industry. But there's no question. It's more challenging. And this year, I think, as I said, will be the litmus test. Rates start dropping materially this year if Tim Mackin gets his head out of the sand and stops looking at 2% as the magic wand, because he's created a third of the inflation rate himself by increasing interest. You know that without the interest rate increase, inflation is well below 2%, so 1.5%. But anyways, that's another story. But
it's incredible, isn't it? It's incredible, isn't it, Lior? The fixation on the 2%, which I get it. I mean, I understand from this big macro global whatever, this is what you're trying to do. But in the circumstances we had with the supply side crunch in 21, you had to adjust your thinking. You were going to get inflation no matter what the rates were under those circumstances.
Exactly. No, I know. And the economists disagree. Benjamin Tall bitterly disagrees with them, and he said he's given up trying to talk to them about that 3% in this current world environment is the right number. But the good part is if interest rates starts coming down, I think that will give comfort to the investors in terms of their ability to finance. Whether that it'll come down fast enough for current closings is another story. What it will help is for new launches. to get the investors back in the market. You know, people keep saying investors are bad, you know, the government, you know, foreign or otherwise, you know, they're taking up supply. It's total horseshit.
Yep.
Because the investors are allowing these larger projects to get off the ground and create a rental supply. Because if you don't have them in a big project, they're not going to get launched. The government doesn't seem to recognize that. They're not driving the prices. They're helping to create supply. And you know, when you take them out of the market, you won't see, how many launches have we seen? I got five projects that are sitting there waiting for the market to come back, and the market will come back when the rates come down, investors come back in. But that's, so, you know, I'm how that will impact over the next year. I'm hopeful that we'll probably see more defaults, but not the flood that's expected, because people have too much money invested in these projects and they'll find a way to close. It's not 1990 all over again.
The only fear I have is we've been, as you say, we're pretty good at avoiding defaults in Canada. And that goes all the way back to the financial crisis in 2008 and everything, even then, although, well, it's mostly because our banks weren't exposed to the asset-backed securities, but whatever. Right. We were able to avoid a lot of the pain. However, here we are in this situation today. Values, prices, as you see, that they call it a housing crisis. You know, the young people can't afford anything. We in governments, and then, you know, leaking even across the road into the central bank. There's going to be, oh my God, we've got to do something to help people afford and get into their housing, right? That's where you start to see the default, isn't it? Because when they pressured the banks, I think there was something just coming out about a 30-year. They did something different with the
amortization terms. They increased the amortization from 25 to 30. It will lighten the debt load, or at least the cash flow debt load of purchasers. Load. But they, you know, the government keeps trying to deal with the market. It gets hot, they raise it to 35. It gets cool, they bring it, you know, they bring it down to 25 from 35, and now they bring it up to 30. You know, next year it'll be something else. You know, this artificial management of things, and the stress test. You know, you had it, and there was some value there. You don't need the stressness now. We have enough stress without the stress test. You know, soften it up. You know, take it away from renewals. It's, you know, there's just such a myopic view up there. You know, this, you know, the one fear of the, you know, of a housing explosion. And now, you know, we have a housing shortage. We actually had a call with Tim Mackin and his crew at the Bank of Canada, a number of developers and myself and other people from Build. And he's looking at ways of increasing supply and affordability. And I was thinking, like, you have it in your hands. Just cut the rates.
Yeah.
You know, like, but I don't know what all the other solutions aren't in his hands. So it was sort of interesting. Oh, we want to learn about this. And so, and what I didn't say anything. I let others speak, but thinking like, what are you going to do with this information? Are you going to do something? Anyways, it was nice of him to reach out that he's at least interested.
Yeah.
But the answer on his is there. And the answer for the government is also there. You cut the HST like you promised to do in 1991, or you raise the thresholds from 400 to a million. The answers are all there. The governments just don't have the balls to do it. That's the problem.
No, they have to be seen to be doing something, or at least they
do all this other bullshit.
It's usually the wrong thing. I mean, you want to increase housing and affordability. How about a 1% rate cut? Just do it. Just do it and watch what happens. You're not going to believe it. Anyways.
Well, what can we do?
Listen,
we don't control them.
We've advised the Central Bank of Canada here, and I think we've advised everybody on the right way to protect themselves in the event of problems with their projects and people running into financial difficulties. So I think we've solved most of the world's problems here.
Sure. Okay, well, I'm glad that was good. In 45 minutes, pretty good.
Not bad, eh? Impressed. Not bad, yeah.
Not bad.
Lior Margulis, a real estate lawyer for Robbins Appleby. You've had some great insights for us here today on The Hammer. Thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to The Hammer. You can find episodes online at CanadianContractor.com or subscribe on your favorite podcasting service. The Hammer is presented by Canadian Contractor Magazine.